Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Frank Sinatra's 100th birthday is December 12th. Today on the program, we're going to spend the hour with Sinatra's biographer, James Kaplan, whose bestseller, Frank, The Voice, from 2010, and a new book, Sinatra, The Chairman, take us behind the legend to give us the man in full, peerless singer, sometimes powerful actor, business mogul, tireless lover, and associate of the powerful and infamous. We're going to be hearing some music as well. And we welcome in James Kaplan. Thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here, Tom. Thank you so much.
What drew you to Sinatra's subject of biography? This, after all, anyone you choose, you're going to spend quite a bit of time with him or her.
Yes, and this marks my 10th year with Frank Sinatra. I have a circumstantial answer to that, and then there's a deeper answer, I guess. But the circumstantial answer is, in 2000, I profiled Jerry Lewis for The New Yorker. And Jerry and I became close over the next few years. He talked about Sinatra a lot, always as Frank. Frank this, Frank that. He was an important figure in Jerry Lewis's life. And I began to think of Sinatra as Frank, almost as though I had known him, too. After a little while, Jerry Lewis asked me to help him write his memoir, which I gladly agreed to do. We wrote a book together called Dean and Me, A Love Story, which came out in 2005. And as we were finishing that book, Jerry invited me to the 2004 Muscular Dystrophy Telethon, which he was still running at that point, in Los Angeles. I went out to the telethon, and one night I went out to dinner with a bunch of the musicians who were working on the show, and about seven guys, men of a certain age. We all went out to an Italian restaurant in Santa Monica, and we drank a lot. We enjoyed ourselves. It was a very pleasant and boozy dinner, and everybody was in very good spirits. And after we had been sitting there for a couple of hours, it came out that every one of these guys had at one time or another worked with Frank Sinatra. And since we were all in a very good mood, I kind of rubbed my hands, expecting to hear the dirt about the women and the mob and the fist fights. But instead, their voices sort of got lower, and each of them spoke with awe about what an absolute musical genius Sinatra had been. And I was very struck by that and very moved by that, very touched by these guys who were, they had no idea they were sitting with a journalist or a biographer. I was just a guy who had helped Jerry in their eyes. They didn't care. They could have said anything. This was the first thing they thought of. And right around that time, a new biography of Sinatra came out, retailing yet again the women and the mob and the fist fights. In this new book, you would never have known that Sinatra sang a note. And I was looking for a next book to do after Jerry Lewis. I was thinking of doing a biography, and I had never written one before. I had written books with other people, their sort of assisted memoirs, with one with John McEnroe and then with Jerry Lewis. And I thought, okay, well, I'll take this on. Little did I know that 10 years would pass. Believe it or not, that was the short answer. But the deeper answer, and I'll try to be brief about it, is that I grew up in the 1950s. Sinatra was very much, he was in the air when I was growing up. He was part of the fiber of my growing up. And even though I was a child of rock and roll, I was 12 when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964, and that changed my life, coming so shortly after the terrible moment of the Kennedy assassination and those dark days that followed it. The Beatles were a blast of light and fresh air, and rock and roll was thrilling, and I loved it then. I love it now. But in 1981, I went to a Frank Sinatra concert at Carnegie Hall, and I was absurdly lucky, got to sit in the front row. I sort of went a little bit tongue-in-cheek, being a rock and roll kid. At that point, I was 30, and by the end of the evening, I was a convert. He was staggeringly great, staggeringly charismatic. His musicianship was absolutely amazing. I had never seen a performance like that, and as I as I began to write this book, I realized that I was dealing with not just a complicated man, but really a musician of Mozartian capability, somebody who comes, a kind of person who comes along maybe every couple of hundred years. And thrown in with all of that, Tom, is the fact that this guy was born in 1915 in Hoboken, New Jersey, when there were cobblestones on the streets and horses drawing coal wagons and ice wagons through the streets. And he died on May 14th, 1998, the night of the Seinfeld finale. His life was the American century. He coincided with so much of the American century, so many events, so many personalities. And on top of that, the guy is an absolute genius. You couldn't have a bigger canvas to paint on. And I wanted to do a big book, and I got two.
Yeah, two big books. That's right. Yeah, a very complex man. I learned quite a bit from this biography. I want to start with the genius, the musical prodigy aspect of the man. Let's hear just a bit of "I've Got You Under My Skin." You could pick just whatever. This is one that I think really swings, really gets going. And then I want to talk a bit about the voice and the musicianship.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might.
And, I kind of want to hear the whole rest of it. He gets really swinging at the end there, but you can hear it's a lot of the Sinatra qualities. Maybe start with the voice itself.
It's an incredible voice, and it's easy to think that that Sinatra throughout his singing career kind of fell out of bed and sang that way, and the opposite is true. Tom, often ask me what the biggest surprise was writing about Sinatra. And I always say the biggest surprise was not some deep and secret piece of gossip, but the deep and secret fact that Sinatra worked incredibly hard on his singing. That he was in the end a great musician who had huge respect for musicians and musicianship and his own art, and from the beginning worked so hard on refining that voice, on doing everything he could to study breath control, to study phrasing. He studied the lyrics of a song so deeply, he read them like a poem before he ever sang a note of a song he was going to do. He studied breath control at the back of the great band leader Tommy Dorsey, in whose orchestra Sinatra sang for 3 years, from 1939 to 1942. He learned a great deal about phrasing from Billie Holiday, who was the same age as Sinatra, but who burst into fame much sooner, and who, as a young unknown, Sinatra used to watch raptly and listen to raptly on 52nd Street in New York. And he took voice lessons from a former Metropolitan Opera singer to learn how to refine that voice. Having said all that, there's a certain spooky, almost X factor to Sinatra's singing that is something we can't quite explain. It's a thing that even after 10 years of working on Sinatra still gives me goosebumps when I hear him sing. He is able, unlike any other singer I can think of, to make you feel that he is feeling those feelings and thinking these thoughts in the moment he is singing them. And It gives such an immediacy, such a freshness to his singing that I really think that that is a voice that will endure over the centuries.
Hmm. You've talked about, in fact, quoting you, his astonishingly intimate singing. And you wanted to say the credit in the one place where Frank Sinatra was capable of creating intimacy.
Yes. He, as his daughter Tina wrote in her very good memoir, My Father's Daughter, my father was a deeply feeling man who was unable to attain a lasting, intimate relationship with another human being. And this was unfortunately true of Sinatra throughout his whole life. He yearned for intimacy. He strove for it on some level. But his music always came first. He knew from the beginning, from the time he was a little kid walking around Hoboken, New Jersey, and as he later said, hearing the music of the spheres, that he was cut out for a special destiny. And that special destiny did not include having deep and lasting relationships that would require that he subordinate his music and his career to any relationship.
And, you know, you can trace a lot of an individual back to their roots. He had a pretty conflicted relationship with his mother, I believe.
He did. His mother, Dolly Sinatra, was a volcanic human being, and in many ways Sinatra's mirror. They were very, very similar. She had a fiery temper. She was pathologically impatient. Both characteristics Frank shared. She was brilliant. She was a brilliant woman. She was a Democratic organizer in Hoboken, New Jersey. She spoke every dialect of Italian, so she could go around the various Italian-American neighborhoods in Hoboken and get out the vote. She was also a midwife. She was also an abortionist and was arrested a couple of times for that. She was unpredictable. And Sinatra later said he never knew whether she was going to hug him or hit him. In fact, she did hit him on numerous occasions. She, Dolly Sinatra, and Frank's father, Marty, ran a bar. They kept a billy club behind the bar in case there was trouble. And whenever Frank caused trouble, Dolly would give him a whack with the billy club. She once pushed him down a flight of stairs. She once pushed him when they were at the seashore. She once pushed him under the water in the surf. This is a woman who stamped on Frank Sinatra's soul, I think, a certain suspicion about human relations, and especially a certain wariness about his relationships with women that would stay with him for his whole life.
Let's take a break when we come back more with James Kaplan. He's completed now his two-volume biography of Frank Sinatra. First was called Frank, the Voice. Second called Sinatra, the Chairman. And this second volume is out in time for the Sinatra Centennial. His 100th birthday is December 12th. If you'd like to join the conversation with your question or comment, you can join us several ways. The first is toll-free phone number 1-800-826-1495. And you can join us by email to upraxcess@gmail.com. We're on Twitter as well, at Utah Public Radio. Let's go out with some Sinatra, and we'll take a break.
This is Management Minute by Professor Scott Hammond.
Strong leaders realize they don't know everything. They listen more than they speak. They invite ideas from everyone and facilitate communication between all. One plant manager works on the shop floor a couple of days a month in order to stay in touch with his employees. Another company president answers phone calls when customer volume goes up. Leading with humility means creating an environment where respect replaces fear, where all jobs are valued. One business owner decided to eliminate her reserved parking and moved her work desk into a cubicle with others. She said excellence is a team sport.
The Management Minute is brought to you by our members and the USU Shingo MBA program at the John M. Huntsman School of Business, a 15-month graduate degree for executives giving knowledge and skills to leverage the principles and tools of lean continuous improvement. Huntsman.usu.edu.
Luck be a lady.
tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
That is a bit from Luck Be a Lady. Frank Sinatra is our subject for the hour today. We're talking with his biographer, James Kaplan. He's out with the second in his two-volume biography. Second is called Sinatra, the Chairman. And as you made reference to James Kaplan earlier, he was born early in the 20th century, died in 1998, and in many ways epitomizes the century. I wonder, there's a phrase, there's a title that we give him, Entertainer of the Century. Justified, do you think?
Totally justified. There was no other entertainer, no other entertainer whose life intersected with so many personalities, so many of the important personalities of the 20th century, with so much of the history of the 20th century, and no other entertainer who had as much power as Sinatra did from... first during World War II, and then after a severe career downturn, staged the most amazing comeback in show business history to gain greater power from the mid-1950s until the end of his life than any other, I think, any other show business figure has really ever had. You can bring up Taylor Swift. You can bring up Michael Jackson. You can bring up the Beatles. But when you say everything about Frank Sinatra, about all the people he knew, about the politicians he knew, about the paths he walked, and the wake he left behind him, about the records he made, the movies he made, the money he made, the impact he made. Entertainer of the century, I think, is completely justified.
I want to play the acceptance speech, 1954. This is after a rapid rise and then a fall, and this completes his comeback. And this is where you begin, Sinatra, the Chairman. So let's hear this.
That's a clever opening. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm deeply thrilled and very moved. And I really, really don't know what to say, because this is a whole new kind of thing, you know. I song and dance man type stuff. And I'm terribly pleased. And if I start thanking everybody, I'll do a one-reeler up here, so I better not. And I'd just like to say, however, that they're doing a lot of songs here tonight, but nobody asked me. But I love you, though. Thank you very much. I'm absolutely thrilled. Thank you.
So this is for his performance in From Here to Eternity. I'll tell you what surprised me about that. I went back and watched that. There's a vulnerability there. You know, you'd have some steel there. You can see some of the tough qualities. But I guess I had in my mind the Sinatra of later years that I was familiar with, steely blue eyes, a tough image, you know, don't mess with him, kind of a thing, a bit closed off. And watching that, I saw much more vulnerability than I expected.
He was vulnerable. That vulnerability you saw was absolutely real. It's a very moving little speech he gave there, and he, I think, meant every word. He had been so far down that he thought he was never going to come back. In fact, 4 months before he gave that acceptance speech at the Oscars in March of 1954, he had made a serious suicide attempt, deeply slit his left wrist. After having lost his wife, Ava Gardner, he thought for good, and it really did turn out to be for good. At that point, she had gone on, run away with a Spanish bullfighter. He thought he would never get her back. He wasn't at all sure that his career would come back, even though he had made From Here to Eternity and gotten wonderful reviews. He didn't know he was going to win that Oscar, and he didn't know that he was going to begin recording that incomparable series of great Capitol albums with Nelson Riddle. he didn't know any of that was lay in his future. And so at that moment, on that March night of 1954, he was genuinely humbled, genuinely grateful, and genuinely vulnerable. And yes, the toughness and the steel was actually always there. Of course, it set in more deeply when he acquired more power and money. But there, the toughness, the steel, the swagger, the bravado always enclosed a sort of molten core of hypersensitivity, vulnerability, and insecurity. I'm not asking anybody to excuse Sinatra's bad behavior, because there was a lot of it. But this was an extraordinarily insecure man, and you see him in that speech at a moment when his insecurities were really at their peak.
I want to quote a couple of passages from the book, have you talk about this. This gets to Sinatra, the man. He says, Sinatra had always been, I love this phrase, like your phrase, like a whole body case of restless leg syndrome. And you say elsewhere, Frank's entire life seemed to be based on the building and release of tension. When the release came in the form of singing, it was gorgeous. When it took the form of fury, it was terrible.
Yes, yes. He was a pathologically impatient man. Again, he inherited this from his mother. It stayed with him his entire life. It unfortunately stained his movie career, where he, in Hollywood, got a reputation as one-take Charlie. He felt always that his best take was his first take in the movies, but that also was trying to cover up the fact that he found movie making deeply boring, and it exacerbated his impatience to the utmost. He felt no such impatience in the recording studio, where if it took 5 takes, 10 takes, 20 takes, in the case of I've Got You Under My Skin, that magnificent recording, 22 takes to get the final take, he would stay for as long as it took, because he knew that this was ultimately going to be his legacy. His recordings were his legacy. So yes, extraordinarily impatient man, and yes, a man who lived tension. He lived tension, and he caused tension in others around him. And when it was released in the singing, it was gorgeous to behold. And very often, when it was released in fury, it was terrible to behold, and many beheld it.
I want to play a scene from the movie Return to Me. And this gets us into several different things. One thing is it gets us into sort of the popular conception, the icon. This is a scene with some old men sitting around and shooting the breeze and talking about favorite singers, and these characters played by Carol O'Connor and Robert Loggia and some other great character actors. Mm. Let's hear this.
This guy you're talking about, he can't sing at all.
Can't sing? How come he's got such a big band?
To drown him out. How many famous Polish singers are there? I got two words for you. Bobby Vincent.
Bobby Vincent.
But what do you got? The Irish Rovers?
Well.
I got three words for you. Mr. Bing Crosby.
Hey. Oh, he made a lovely priest.
Yeah, he made a beautiful priest, but he beat the hell out of his kids.
So doesn't mean he couldn't sing. Sinatra beat up everybody.
Frank did not. His people did. He did not.
So that's, an appreciation. They're going to their ethnicity for the great singers. And, of course, the Italians have, a bunch of people. So this idea that, we have this sort of the stereotype of Frank's people beating up people. Robert Loggia there was careful to say Frank never did, but his people did. I want to use that as a segue to get into the man behind the legend. And there are some tough things to deal with, which you deal with in the book.
Sure,
I want you to talk a bit about Frank Sinatra's bad behavior.
There was a lot of bad behavior. There was a lot of bad behavior, and there were a lot of reasons for that bad behavior. But one thing I want to talk about, and again, I'm nowhere excusing Frank Sinatra's bad behavior. I want to say, take a step back, Tom, and just say that over the 10 years I worked on these two books, I never got bored with Sinatra. He was a genius, and among the various types of genius he possessed, unfortunately, he had a genius too for making himself dislikable. as Pete Hamill, who wrote a marvelous short book about Sinatra called Why Sinatra Matters, said, his shortcomings were regrettable. This was true. He had a genius for making himself dislikable, and so I frequently disliked him as I was writing about him. But I was never bored with him, and I never... That thing that happens to some biographers never happened to me. I never felt contempt for him. And what I want to say about the bad behavior is a couple of things. I want to address the fact that this was a guy who grew up as an Italian-American in Hoboken, New Jersey, at a time when Italian-Americans were just a half step up the social scale from African-Americans, when Italian-Americans, much like African-Americans, were regarded in America at large as happy, singing, dancing people. And unlike African-Americans, happy, singing, dancing people who like to eat spaghetti and now and then shoot people. That was the cliche. That was the image of Italian-Americans. I think, by the way, that some of that image lingers to this day, unfortunately. Sinatra had to deal with that. I think it made him feel early on a sort of attraction to the mafia guys he met in his life and his career. He saw them as Italian-Americans who had power, and he saw them, this was incorrect, but he saw them as men of power and men of honor and respect, and he idolized them, and he idolized them his whole life. Got him into a lot of bad situations and stained him, really. Unfortunately stained the genius with the association to these guys. The bad behavior, much of it came from alcohol. Sinatra began drinking heavily during the Ava years, as Ava was beginning to get bored with him and beginning to leave him and then finally left. He drank more and more heavily, and he was an angry drunk. Alcohol did not do good things to him. And so much of his terrible behavior was stoked by overindulgence in alcohol.
And of course, Sinatra's not the only genius to have, problems, skeletons in the closet, if you will. I wonder, diving into Sinatra, all facets, there could be a danger that colors your appreciation for the music. I wonder how you separate that out.
I listen to the songs. There is definitely a split that one has to make. And this is, I'm not preaching to anybody else. If your dislike of Sinatra's bad behavior, his mob associations, his image so colors your feelings about his music that you can't bear to listen to it, I'm not gonna tell you that you're a bad person for feeling that way. However, I make the separation. When I hear that glorious album that Frank made in early 1967 with the similarly brilliant Antonio Carlos Jobim, the great Brazilian singer-songwriter, the album Francis Albert Sinatra and Antonio Carlos Jobim, a great and extraordinarily gentle album. When I listen to that album and I listen to the gorgeous songs on that album and realize that he was making this album in the midst of furies in his life. Rock and roll was destroying popular music as he had known it. His marriage to Mia Farrow was unraveling already. Las Vegas was as Howard Hughes bought the casinos of Las Vegas and took over from the mob. Las Vegas was changing permanently, and Sinatra was furious at all these things. Yeah. And so when you look at that contrast and hear that glorious and very serene, sublime music, you just have to be able, as Scott Fitzgerald said, great minds are capable of entertaining two opposite ideas simultaneously. You have to try and strive to be a great mind.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dwell, completely on the the bad boy. Just to say this, it's some of these things that he did, or at least that he was tangentially involved with, would, without his power and wealth, might have landed him in jail.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which we again describes unfortunately, it's a running theme with some of our entertainers. I want to read this passage. This is comparing Ava Gardner to Sinatra. Like Frank, she was infinitely restless and easily bored. In both, this tendency could lead to casual cruelty to others, sometimes to each other. Both had titanic appetites for food, drink, cigarettes, diversion, companionship, and sex. Both distrusted sleep. Both hated being alone.
So true of both of them. And ultimately, this was like subatomic collision of two like forces. They could not. They were an unstable compound, Frank and Ava. They could never truly bond. They were never, despite their enormous passion for each other, they were never going to be the couple who settled down and raised children. She didn't want children, and he didn't want a wife who worked, and they were just too alike to stay together. He could never conquer her. She was not a conquest, ever, even remotely. And so many of the women he was involved with were conquests. And that's really what kept him interested and also what kept them apart. But it kept him fascinated with her until the end of her days and the end of his days, I think.
Let's take another break. When we come back, more with James Kaplan. He has completed his 2-volume biography, Frank Sinatra. The new volume is called Sinatra, the Chairman. And we'll talk more about Frank Sinatra. We'll be hearing some music as well. Let's go out with the girl from Ipanema, since you mentioned the collaboration with Jobim. More following the break.
Goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah. When she walks, she's like a samba that swings so cool and sways so gentle that when she passes, each one she passes goes.
The world comes at you fast, on air, online, on your phone. At All Things Considered, we cut through the clutter and take you beyond the headlines. There's more to every story. Listen every afternoon.
The holiday season is supposed to bring us joy as a time for celebration and being together with family. But for some, as the holiday season approaches, the stress outweighs the joy. We want to hear from you. Tell us how you're feeling about the upcoming holiday season. Utah Public Radio has partnered with the Salt Lake Tribune and American Public Media to create the Utah Public Insight Network, a database of people whose one-of-a-kind experiences, ideas, and expertise can help us better report and tell stories that matter. Let us know how you feel about the upcoming holidays. Visit upr.org and click on Become a Source.
And now the end is near. So I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear. I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I traveled.
So that is Frank Sinatra with My Way, and that's I wanted to begin this last segment with James Kaplan with My Way. It's iconic, of course. It's very much associated with the man, and epitomizes him in a lot of ways. I think James Kaplan.
His audience like to think that it epitomizes him, and what I was saying was that Frank Sinatra actually did not like My Way.
Really?
He did not like the song. He would often announce it in concert. I hate this song. I don't want to sing it. But his audiences demanded it. And why is that? Because Because audiences have, we all have our fantasies about our idols, and the fantasy that Frank Sinatra's gigantic audience always had about him was that he lived his life as he pleased. Well, that was true of much of his life, but of course, with all of our lives, there are forces beyond our control, and that was true of Sinatra too. With all his money, with all his power, a lot of it was like Midas, where everything turned to gold, but there was little that he could feel or touch or eat or grasp onto. There was a certain paradox in all that power that he gained. And we like to think that Sinatra had things his way, but Sinatra felt that that lyric by Paul Anka was ultimately too foursquare, too on the money. He was Sinatra was a great admirer, a huge admirer of the great lyrics of the likes of Cole Porter, of Lorenz Hart, of Hammerstein, and of Irving Berlin, and he felt that the lyric of My Way was too obvious, and in the end, that it was boastful. And for all of Sinatra's swagger and at times brutishness, he was not a boastful man. He felt that My Way bragged, and he didn't want to be bragging. But he would go to every concert, and the people demanded to hear My Way. They wanted to hear it. They wanted to think that that was the Sinatra that they knew and loved. In the end, the real Sinatra was more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm. What did he have a favorite song?
He had dozens of them, Tom. Mm-hmm. He loved all those songwriters that I mentioned. He revered them. He revered his in-house songwriters, Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen. Whenever there was a great lyric, whenever there was a great song, he knew it. He had. This was the man, by the way, who we don't give him enough credit for this, but really created, who landed the idea of the standard of the great American song in American culture. He came along at a time in the late 1940s when all of America was listening to the Hit Parade, and Sinatra performed on the Hit Parade, and a lot of that music was junk. Sinatra really loved Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, and he felt that these songs ought to be promoted and played, and he did it. He sang them. He sang them in concert. He sang them on his albums, and he made those songs important. And they really became, those songs, I think, the backbone of his career and the backbone of his concert career after he came back from his brief retirement in 1971. Of course, he sang a lot of other things. He sang My Way, and he sang Strangers in the Night, and he tried to sing new material, but the spine of his career, the center of his career, the core, the great core of his career was those great American standards.
I want to talk a bit about the years after that farewell concert, 1971. Then he had a comeback album, I believe, in 73, and you know, he went on. But in some respects, certainly popular culture was passing him by. And he tried to keep up a little bit. He'd wear a Nehru jacket, right, and a few things. What were his feelings about that, about being a bit out of the spotlight?
He hated getting old. Who among us does not hate getting old? Frank Sinatra hated it more than anyone because he was, his entire career, his entire life, he was always the hippest guy in the room, and he was... he was the most vigorous guy in the room, the guy with the most money, the most fame, the guy who could attract the most women. Suddenly here he was married, he was no longer the Lothario he had been. He was on his fourth marriage and he didn't get around the way he used to. He came into middle age and then late middle age and then his elder years. He didn't like getting old. He hated losing his faculties. He hated rock and roll. He hated what was what the music business was becoming. at the same time, and he tried to accommodate. He tried to, I won't say accommodate, that's the wrong word. He was not an accommodating character. He tried to adapt. Yes, he wore the Nehru jacket. He sang George Harrison something. He sang other new songs. He sang Joni Mitchell. It never quite worked for him. What worked for him was being himself. And when he came back after the retirement and got into a tuxedo and became more or less strictly a concert artist, he pretty much stopped making albums. He made a few here and there. He pretty much stopped making movies. He became a concert artist, went out on the road, took his great repertoire with him, mixing it up here and there, changing it up. But he very wisely saw what his essence was and who his audience was. And his audience, in the end, was gigantic. You could call him a niche performer in his later years. I would argue that if you're going to call it a niche, it was a very, very large niche. It's a huge audience he had and continues to have. And I think that once he got over the idea of trying to change and act modern and act young and do a lot of new material, once he settled down and just became more at ease with being the Frank Sinatra that he wanted to be and his audiences wanted him to be, he held on to the huge influence he had had throughout his career.
I want to take you back to the beginnings of his career when he really first hit it big. I think we forget that Frank Sinatra. There's some great music there as well. He's singing a bit higher, and he's a cultural icon. Young women are screaming. I don't know if this is a new phenomenon, but it's fairly new. I think he was the Justin Bieber, before Justin Bieber.
No, the young ladies never screamed for anybody the way they screamed for Frank Sinatra in the 1940s. He was a band singer with two band leaders, Harry James and then Tommy Dorsey. And what Tommy Dorsey, who was a great star in his own right, quickly began to see when Sinatra was singing for him was that whenever Sinatra sang on the bandstand, the young women in the audience would all edge toward the bandstand with their eyes wide and their mouths open, and they would sigh and sometimes scream and sometimes faint. Dorsey hated it. He wanted to be the star, but Sinatra saw it, and he quit Dorsey, and he was the first singer during the big band era to go out on his own. At first, he thought he wasn't going to make it, but then with that gigantic Paramount concert, in the beginning of 1943, he made it big time, and throughout the years of the war, World War II, he was really an American superstar. He was singing those beautiful ballads of longing on Columbia Records. He was expressing the feelings that all of America felt of sadness and longing, fear about the boys fighting overseas. But then, when the war ended, things changed very rapidly, and the first thing to change was American taste in popular music. And unfortunately, Sinatra's records very rapidly stopped selling after World War II, and that was just the beginning of his troubles.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason for his first fall was there was disapproval that he didn't go fight in World War II, I believe.
Well, I would call that more the seed of the problems that followed that. There was a great amount of controversy about Sinatra during World War II. He was widely reputed to be a draft dodger. He got two deferments, first for being a father. That was a valid deferment for a couple of years during the war, but then that was revoked as more men were needed. He was re-examined again and found not only to be psychologically unfit, and that's a big subject, but also to have a punctured eardrum. And I do think he legitimately had a punctured eardrum. It didn't matter, though, because as the historian of World War II and himself a Marine in the South Pacific in World War II, a man named William Manchester wrote, Frank Sinatra was the most hated man in the armed forces during World War II. these guys fighting overseas all felt that Sinatra was a draft dodger who was home and making time with all of their women. Well, to a great degree, they were right about that latter fact. He may not have been a draft dodger, but he certainly was making time with a lot of their women, and he was not fighting. But that wasn't his records continued to sell, and even the guys overseas, as much as they hated him, the soldiers and sailors listened to Sinatra. It was only when popular music changed after the war that his troubles began to happen, and then there were a lot of self-inflicted troubles that quickly followed that really punctured his career and all but ended it.
Mm-hmm. Including a trip to a mafia convention, I believe. I wonder if you could expand on that a bit. You mentioned it a little earlier in the show. That's one thing, you know, bullet points about Frank Sinatra. He was attracted, I think, to power, political power. I guess, you know, mafia would be part of that. Where did that attraction to the mafia come from?
The attraction to the mafia came when he was a young Italian-American kid in Hoboken, and Italian-Americans were looked down upon, and as I said before, and he saw these mafia guys he knew as Italian-Americans who had power, and he saw them, Sinatra saw them, incorrectly, as not only men of power, but men of honor. Well, that is debatable, to say the least, the latter part. But they did have power, and he, much as small boys idolize cowboys and soldiers and sports heroes, Frank Sinatra idolized the mafia and did for his entire life.
And political power as well. He, I think, very much appreciated being able to pal around with JFK.
He did. And we have to draw a line there and separate his attraction to political power from, I think, from his attraction to criminal power. Sinatra's political beliefs were deep and passionate from the very beginning. His mother was a passionate admirer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Frank Sinatra, from his early years, agreed with her. And Sinatra stayed a liberal, a deeply passionate liberal Democrat throughout his teen years, young adulthood, and into middle age. It was only in the late 60s that his political beliefs swung sharply to the right. But he was, I want to say, of course, yes, he was attracted to political power. Political power was sexy to him, and it was very especially sexy in the person of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. But that attraction to power was strongly yoked to idealistic feelings about what America should and could be. So there was it wasn't a cold calculation on Sinatra's part. It was it was very emotional.
Just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to bring this back to legacy, and we talked about the idol to the Bobby Soxers and the whole sweep of the career, and he was in the spotlight for so long, and he's still there. He's still the music will live on, I think, forever. What's the legacy for you?
The legacy is the music. You just said it, Tom. The music will live on. Forever is a long time, but I think it will. I think Sinatra's voice will endure down through the decades, if not the centuries. Unlike other voices. And as I said back at the beginning, there is, beyond all the hard work that Sinatra put into his singing, beyond all the technical factors, the breath control and the phrasing, the superlative phrasing and the deep feeling for the lyrics, there is this X factor. There is this feeling when he is singing that he is living in the song, that he's feeling the feelings, thinking the thoughts as he is singing the song, that it communicates directly kind of with the listener's spinal cord. It communicates directly with some deep down instinctual part of the listener, and it's what in me creates the goosebumps, and I think in so many other people too. And I really think that that's his true legacy. You have that great mystique, and young people love it, and I love it too. And the myth of the Rat Pack and those swinging years and the tuxedos and the late nights and the drinking and the fun. A lot of that is myth. But my contention is that if you had the mystique without the voice, that would fade over time. If some natives thousands of years from now managed to dig up a CD and a CD player and make it work and listen to that voice without knowing anything about the Rat Pack, I think they would get goosebumps. I think the voice is what is going to make him last.
Just 30 seconds left. You've spent 10 years with Frank Sinatra. Have you chosen a new subject?
I have not. Big Nancy, his first wife, Nancy Sinatra, famously said when asked why she never remarried after Frank Sinatra, she would give a Mona Lisa smile and shrug and say, "After Frank Sinatra." So I'm not going to torment myself with trying to come up with a big biography subject, at least not yet. For the time being, I'm enjoying having written this book and talking about it with other people such as yourself. And I'm going to let my career take care of itself, and I'm sure a next subject will come to me. But I don't have it yet. That is the honest truth, Tom.
Well, we'll look for something down the road. In the meantime, we're enjoying the two-volume biography. The latest volume is now out. Sinatra, the Chairman. The author is James Kaplan. Thank you so much.
Great talking with you, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We're going to hear some more Sinatra as we go out. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my babe and one more for the road. I got the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad, can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you've gotta be true.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM HD1 Logan.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Science at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio.